Okay, so today I'm going to start talking about the reductive groups in the absolute case, that is, over the algebraically closed field. First, let's just start with any linear algebraic group. And let's assume that it contains at least one torus. The way I define tori, I assume that they're non-trivial. Okay, then if you look at the set of tori in G, it has maximal elements. To inclusion. And not surprisingly, we call them maximal tori. Such tori are maximal tori. And general fact is that all maximal tori are conjugate. Okay, when we start looking at the k rational points for a non-algebraically closed field, this in fact is not true, but just over the algebraically closed field, we're fine, all maximal tori are conjugate. Now, so let's just take any torus. Okay, so we have the adjoint representation, which I mentioned yesterday. This is a homomorphism of algebraic groups, and we're going to restrict to T. So we'll look at T. Okay, well, it sits inside this general linear group, and it consists of commuting semi-simple elements. Okay, and therefore is diagonalizable. So now look at an alpha in the characters of T. And look in the V algebra for elements which have the following property, that when you apply add T for T an element in the torus to X, you just get alpha of TX. Okay, so we're going to do this for all T. Okay, so we're looking at the things that are in a simultaneous eigenspace of add T, out of the torus. Okay. Now, of course, if you just choose alpha randomly, then much of the time this will be zero, but at other times you get something non-zero. So the non-zero alpha, so writing the character group additively, the non-zero alpha, the non-trivial, let's just say non-trivial, a non-trivial alpha such that G alpha is not zero are the roots, what we call the roots of G relative to T. And we'll see that these roots relative to various phi are important in the structure of reductive groups, but you can define this without having a reductive group to begin with. Set of roots of G with respect to T or relative to T is usually, I'm going to denote it by phi GT. Okay, and now look at the elements in the group that centralize the torus T. Closed subgroup, and it's actually equal to the identity component of the normalizer. Group W G T of T and G is the quotient. So we get a finite group. Obviously, this group acts on the torus T, and we can then transfer that action to an action on the set of characters as well. So, that's on T, and therefore on the characters of T, and it also permutes the roots. Roots of T and G. Okay. Now, here I just assume that T is a torus. Now, if I take a maximal torus, then I would actually call this group the Weyl group of G, because in fact, it's, as an abstract group, independent of the choice of maximal torus, given the fact that all maximal tori are conjugate. Okay? Of course, if I start varying my tori, then I'm going to get different groups. So if I don't have a maximal torus, I really should say the Weyl group of T, of G, of T and G. So if T is maximal, we call the Weyl group of G. Okay, because as a group, it's independent of choice of G, of maximal torus, as they're all conjugate.
Are reasonable people that this group depends on the conjugate?
Yes, but as a finite group.
Uh-huh. not economic argument to be between any two Y groups to be preserved.
I'm usually you're getting something like a dihedral group or a symmetric group or something like that. So if you want to move from one vowel group to the other, you just use an element that conjugates one torus to the other.
So different elements give you different identification.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay, so now getting it towards reductive groups, an algebraic group G contains a unique maximal normal solvable subgroup. And it's closed. So it's an algebraic group. So its identity component is what we call the radical. The radical of G. Let's call it R of G. Okay, now I want to look at a subgroup of the radical. Look at the set of unipotent elements in here. So we have some algebraic group, and we have a notion, we have a Jordan decomposition, we have a notion of unipotent elements. So look at the set of unipotent elements in here. So Ru, G, be the set of unipotent elements. Elements in the radical. Now, it turns out that this is a subgroup of the radical. And, well, let's say it's a closed normal subgroup of G. Makes it, again, an algebraic group, and it's called the unipotent radical of G. So for any linear algebraic group, I can define a unipotent radical. Now, suppose G is non-trivial and connected. G is non-trivial and connected, and the radical is trivial, then we say that G is semi-simple. Trivial and connected, and this unipotent radical is trivial, we say G is reductive. Okay, so of course every semi-simple group is reductive, but there are lots of reductive groups that are not semi-simple. But you can say something about a relation between reductive and semi-simple groups. Reductive groups are more useful to work with because they're easier to use inductive arguments with. When you take the centralizer of a torus in a reductive group, you get a reductive group. If you take a centralized over torus and a semisimple group, you still get a reductive group. You don't get a semisimple group, so it's not so useful to stick with the semisimple groups in general. In fact, if you want to understand semisimple groups, you basically have to understand reductive groups. So we have also a notion of rank. Rank of G is defined to be the dimension of any maximal torus. Then we also have a notion of semisimple rank. G, it is defined to be the rank of the quotient G mod its radical, which actually is a semisimple group. We'll see that in a moment. And the reductive rank I'll define it as the rank of G mod its uniform radical. Okay, now suppose you look at the derived group of G. So it's the group generated by the commutators. Well, it's a closed subgroup of G. And it's connected when G is connected. Okay, now let's take a reductive group. Then, first of all, you can say the following. The derived group is semisimple. You can also identify what the radical actually is. It's the connected component, the identity component of the center. So if you look at the center of the group, G be reductive with center set of G. If you look at the connected component of the identity in the center, well, and this is a closed subgroup, so it's an algebraic group, and so you can look at its identity component, and it turns out to be the radical of the reductive group, and also it's a torus. You also know that the radical intersected with the derived group is finite. And you can write anything in G as a product of something in the radical times something in the derived group. So this may be useful in certain situations where you really want to work with a semisimple group, but you have a reductive group. If you can somehow reduce to working with a derived group, then you are working with a semisimple group. Okay. All right, so now I'm just going to assume that G is reductive. Let's take a Taurus. G. Then the centralizer is a reductive group. Question? What do you mean? I mean, it is a torus, so it's an algebraic group. If you have a reductive group, you have to take a reductive group. No, it not for an arbitrary algebraic group, but certainly if you take a reductive group, the radical will always be a torus. Yeah. So I'm really just working with reductive groups. I'm not talking about the general setting anymore. Okay, so if I take a torus, its centralizer is a reductive group. And that's very useful for inductive arguments. Now let's assume that it's maximal, because the structure will actually be determined by the roots relative to a maximal torus. And let script little t be the Lie algebra. Okay, now I actually don't know if I need that, so let's just leave that and see if I don't. I mean, I need to mention that. Oh, yes, I do. Sorry. Let T be the Lie algebra. And we'll have our roots. So we look at, let's call it T, the roots of T. With respect to relative to G. And now we have the following properties. Let's look at the way the Lie algebra decomposes relative to T and the various root spaces. So if alpha is in C, the subspace that I called G alpha before is what we call a root space. So we're going to get the following kind of thing happening. Not surprisingly, some of them are actually obvious. If you look at T, so it's going to be a subalgebra in the Lie algebra, and then T directs sum the various root spaces. Gives you the whole Lie algebra by what? Direct sum. Okay, it's a big direct sum. Yes. and the dimensions of the G alphas, the root spaces, are all one. So I'm going to. I'm going to just talk about them as root spaces for all alpha. Let's see. Now this is in the case where you are working over the algebraic closure and you are working with a maximal torus. Okay. Now take a root and then just look at its kernel. You get a subgroup of T, which might not be connected, so take its identity component. T alpha, take the kernel of alpha and the identity component. Then you have a torus. And it has codimension 1 in T. So T mod T alpha has dimension 1. If you have an alpha, let's look at the centralizer of this torus. Okay, so it's some reductive group, and it has actually semisimple rank Z alpha. Excuse me, I'm going to call it Z alpha. Z alpha. It's a bold face set, it's not the integers. See the centralizer how this works. Then it's a reductive group. And it has semi-simple rank 1. Like if you look at this and you mod out by, well, you actually don't have rank 1 because it contains the torus, but we'll maybe see the more later why this is semi-simple rank 1. Well, you can see it from the following probably. And you can look at its Lie algebra. The algebra, which I'm going to call group Z alpha of this group, satisfies the following. You can write it as a direct sum. Of the root space for alpha and minus alpha. Oh, I should maybe mention that if alpha is in phi, minus alpha is in phi. So writing the inverse is in of anything a root is also a root. So if you look at the Lie algebra of the centralizer of this torus, T alpha, you get the Lie algebra of T, and then you get two of the root spaces. Right. Now if you look at the group G, you've got these various reductive subgroups of G, each of semi-simple rank 1, those in fact will generate the whole group. So it's generated by those fairly small reductive subgroups. Alpha ranging over the set of all roots. You can identify the center. So we know that the radical is the identity component of the center, and the center will actually be just the intersection of the various T alphas. So if you look at the intersection of the kernels of all the roots, you'll get the center. And then, of course, if you take the identity component of that, you'll get the radical, because we know this radical is the identity component of that. Okay. Another fact related to picking out subgroups corresponding to roots. There exists a unique connected T-stable relative to conjugation by T subgroup having the algebra equal to the root space G alpha. Okay, so actually that might be in the way that, let me just raise this a bit. Let's call this U alpha of G. Having Lie algebra G alpha. And it's also contained in not surprisingly, if you look at the decomposition of the Lie algebra of Z alpha, you see that you have T and then you have the root space for alpha and minus alpha. So in fact, U alpha and U minus alpha will both be in that group. And you can say that this group is actually generated by T and U alpha and U minus alpha if you want. Okay. what else can we do? We can now start looking at actions on the vowel group. Let's take something in the normalizer. And let's look at its image in the quotient, the vowel group. The corresponding element of the vowel group, which we usually just write W now. Then we know that the vowel group acts on the characters of T, and so if you look at the, I don't have to take an alpha, right? Let an alpha be a root, then it's a character of T, so W of alpha is another root. And, W alpha will be another root. And then you could say, well, I've got the subgroup U W alpha, and it would just be the same as the conjugate of U alpha by N. Okay, not surprising that the conjugation action of the normalizer corresponds with the action of the vowel group on the roots seen as characters of T. Okay. Of course, this works for every alpha. Okay. Now we have a nice homomorphism from the additive group. These groups here, the U alphas, are actually isomorphic to the additive group. In a nice way, in sort of a canonical way. So there exists an isomorphism that's, say, epsilon alpha from the additive group. Okay. And it has the nice property that if I conjugate, okay, so I can look at an element of this group and conjugate by an element of the torus, write the element of the group as an image of something in the additive group, okay, and then I will get the same thing as if I evaluated that isomorphism on alpha of Tx for T and T. And X in the additive group. Okay, so we know that conjugation by T preserves this group. And so this is just saying there's a nice isomorphism where you see the conjugate from the additive group to U alpha, where you see the conjugation of T is just corresponding to first applying, evaluating, you know, the root applied here. So that's something that is quite useful. And then, question? No, it's not unique. The groups, we just take the U alphas together with T, will generate G. And this is just a variation of one of the earlier statements. When you say that G is generated by the Z alphas, well, Z alpha is really generated by U alpha and U minus alpha and by T. And so if G is generated by the Z alphas, then this would automatically follow from that. Okay. Okay, now I want to look at the roots more closely. And actually, I will be doing writing some examples. I have them on overhead slides. I'm not sure if I'll get to them today, but at some point I will be setting up examples, showing you what these look like in certain reductive, what the various subgroups and so on look like in particular examples. Okay, so now I'm just going to call the characters a T, I'm just going to call it X. And I'm going to take, I want a vector space, so I'm going to tensor X over the integers with the reals. The set T is what we call, well, it's a subset of V, obviously, is a root system. So, what is an abstract root system? In a vector space V, in a finite dimensional real vector space, real vector space V is a subset, I'll also call it V, of V, which satisfies certain axioms. This set has to be finite. V is finite. You have to span V. And 0 does not belong to the set. Well, actually, that's the way we defined the roots. We took the non-trivial characters of the torus, which have G alpha being non-zero. So we're okay in the specific example above. If you have something in C, a root, there exists a reflection. Reflection S alpha relative to alpha which also has a property that it preserves has to take the set phi to itself. So let me just write this. Here, a reflection. By a reflection, I just mean a linear transformation from V to V, sending alpha to minus alpha, and restricts to the identity map on a subspace of codimension 1. Just want a reflection relative to alpha, there's going to be many ways of doing this. You send alpha to minus alpha, and then you find a subspace of codimension 1, and you make the thing be the identity on that. But you also have to, in the axiom, have the additional condition that you must map the set phi back into itself. Okay, and that actually is going to end up uniquely determining what the self alpha is going to be. And there's one other axiom too. You also have the following condition. If you have two roots, alpha and beta, and you look at what is S alpha D to beta, or does something, and then you subtract beta, you must get back an integer multiple of alpha. Okay, so this would give you a definition of what an abstract root system is. You have a subset. It's finite, it's spanned, it doesn't contain zero. You have reflection, existence of certain reflections, and you also have this third condition here. All right. Now, there's another axiom which is sometimes added, but I'm not going to give it as an axiom. I'll just give it as an extra property. A root system is reduced if for each alpha in phi, plus and minus alpha are the only multiples of alpha which are in phi. In general, what can happen, this may not be totally obvious, but you can also have, if you just have a root system satisfying these three axioms, it can happen that you have twice alpha being in there, or conversely, you can have alpha over 2 belonging as well. But a root system is reduced if you don't have that happening. And if we look at the setup that we have here, where we have a reductive group and we took a maximal torus and we looked at the roots of the torus relative to G, it will be a reduced root system. So if we take our phi gt, this is a reduced root system. Okay, now going back to the abstract thing, we say the rank of phi of any abstract root system is just the dimension of the vector space. Okay, and we have associated to, maybe I'll raise this a little, you can see it. Associated to a root system, you also have a vowel group, which comes from just looking at the reflections S alpha, then looking at the group generated by those reflections. So we may call this the abstract vowel group if we want to distinguish it for the abstract vowel group of a root system. WP is the subgroup. Well, each of those reflections that you have is invertible, so you can think of it as an element of GLV, and then you can just look at the subgroup of GLV generated by the S alpha. By the set S alpha, as alpha ranges over. This is an example of a reductive group, reduced system in the reduced root system in the V that I have in V equals X. Okay. And if you look at the vowel group that you have defined here, in terms of a normalizer, a torus modus centralizer, that's going to be isomorphic to the abstract vowel group of the root system. So the vowel group CT is isomorphic to the vowel group of the root system. Okay? So this is why you've seen a lot of literature, a lot of results about abstract root systems, because they occur naturally for reductive groups. So sometimes we work just with the root systems. Okay. Now, I want to look more closely at what are called bases of root systems. So suppose I have a root system phi, which you may just be thinking of as the root system of this maximal torus in this reductive group, is a subset delta alpha 1 up to alpha L. One more comment I should make. What is the rank here of the root system, the dimension here? So the rank of phi is the semi-simple rank. Rank of G.
Mm-hmm. You want V then to be the subset spanned by the roots. I mean, in general, G is just the vector and the dimension is far as
that's true. I might have too much, right? Well, I could just take the subgroup generated by phi. Thanks. Yeah, in the semi-simple case, that would have been okay here, but I have too much in general. Yeah, so here, look at, I have to be careful about dimensions. This is the subgroup of x generated. Basically, what's happening in the reductive case, we want to ignore the center when we look at the root. We basically are ignoring the center when we look at the roots because the center commutes with everything, right? So it doesn't affect the root spaces at all, and so we want to drop it from everything, so we don't take all of x. Okay. So a base here, where L is the rank, is just a subset that is a basis. Delta is a basis of B. And it has a property that each phi, each alpha in phi, can be expressed, well, not can be expressed, I mean, you don't have a choice, it's a linear combination of the alpha I. Has the form, let's do it this way. Has the form. Okay, so you're going to have C, I, alpha I, I goes from 1 to L, where no two of the CIs have different signs. Okay? CIs will actually be integers. And no two of the CIs have different signs. So some of them can be zero, but and since alpha is non-zero, at least one of them is going to be non-zero, and then after that, everything else that's non-zero has the same sign. Okay, so all greater than or equal to zero, all less than or equal to zero. Okay. The elements of delta are called simple roots. And then we also have a notion of positive roots. If you take, this will come up later, phi plus, the alphas in C such that the CIs are all greater than or equal to zero, where this, of course, the CI here depends on alpha, right? So that's the ones where they're non-negative, and phi minus, we call it negative roots, where the CIs are less than or equal to zero.
Does base always exist?
Yes, for any abstract root system, you have a base. Pardon?
Yeah, is it clear to see that?
It's pretty straightforward, yes. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so not only do bases exist, if I just choose an alpha, I can find a base containing it. So if I just pick any alpha randomly, if alpha is in phi, there exists a base containing alpha. So if I, for some reason, want alpha to be part of a base, I can arrange that. Okay. If we have a base, remember the Valgrind was generated by the reflections S alpha. In fact, to get the Valgrind, you really only need to take the reflections coming from the alphas in a base. So we're going to restrict to a smaller set of generators. And again, when you look at generators of the group, I don't know if I still got these facts written down. Let me see if I do. I was talking about the fact that the group is generated by the subgroup Z alpha as alpha ranges over the roots. Well, you could just take the subgroup Z alpha as alpha ranges over a base. All right, now you can arrange, you can take an inner product on your vector space that is invariant under the vowel group. So I'm going to do that. So there is an inner product on V with respect to which each W in the Weyl group each W is orthogonal. It's an orthogonal linear transformation. And you can actually show that if you have alpha and beta roots, you can say explicitly what the integer multiple you need. What you get when you take S alpha beta minus beta, it is, well, let's write this way, S alpha beta equals beta minus, and then twice inner product beta with alpha divided by inner product length of alpha squared alpha. Okay, so you can actually, in specific examples, write down what these reflections actually are. Okay. And a Weyl chamber in V is a connecting component in the complement of the union of the hyperplanes orthogonal to the roots. So we have this vowel group, and it's just a subgroup, particular subgroup of GLV, and it's going to actually act on these vowel chambers. So here, what I'm doing is I'm just saying, okay, well, you're looking at the root as a vector, and there's a hyperplane orthogonal to it relative to your inner product, and you're taking the union of those hyperplanes and then looking at its complement, which is not connected, and then the connected component of it is called the vowel chamber. Now, if you look at this set of vowel chambers, in V, and the set of bases of the root system, they actually correspond bijectively. So, and the set, I'll erase this in a moment for those of you who, for which that's in the way, of bases of V probably not the best way to do this, I just covered, well, you'll have to this is the first two lines there. The set of bases of phi correspond in a natural way and this is somewhat intuitive if you move across one of these hyperplanes so there's going to be some sign change happening in your coefficients correspond in a natural way and w the vowel group permutes them simply transitively. Both these sets, simply transitively. Okay, so these are not really difficult to verify, and if all the notation is overwhelming, it does help to look at examples. And I'm obviously not going to get to the examples today, but I will tomorrow. Okay, now a couple more definitions to finish. If I want to define coroots, if I have an alpha in C, then remember I have this set of the group of one parameter subgroups of T, I'm going to find an element that corresponds to that in a nice way. There exists a unique alpha check in the one parameter subgroups of T such that, and remember I had last time written down this pairing between X and Y, which is just composition of the one-parameter subgroup and the character. So the pairing I get by composing is actually just this coefficient that occurs here, coefficient of alpha that occurs there, okay. And these alpha checks are called coroots. The vectors alpha check coroots and will generate a root system. Form a root system. These view these as in the dual of V, and it's called the dual root system. Okay, and if you look at the abstract vowel group of the dual root system, it will be isomorphic to. Root system of the original root system and the isomorphism, the natural isomorphism is to take the reflection corresponding to alpha tech and corresponds to map it to the reflection corresponding to alpha. Okay. Won't be talking a lot about dual root systems, but they do come up in what we call root data, so you need to have that definition. Okay, so now I'm running out of time, so what I want to do is talk about root datums, root data, next time, which are basically set up for root data. You need the reductive group, the maximal torus, the characters of the torus, the roots, the one-parameter subgroups, and the dual root system. Okay, and those are going to actually parameterize the isomorphism classes of reductive groups. So we'll talk about that a bit next time and do some examples. And then talk about parabolic subgroups and reductive groups. And at the end, assuming there'll be time, talk about what happens when we work over the rational points of where we have non-algebraically closed fields.